Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's a frontline 3 years in the making. Last Days of Solitary is a groundbreaking look at the controversial practice of solitary confinement in American prisons. We're joined today by filmmaker Dan Edge. Last Days of Solitary airs tonight on SDPB-TV at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Dan is joining us from England. Dan, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thank you.
So let's talk about the beginning, the opening scenes of this film, this frontline documentary. You look inside this segregation unit, the Maine State Prison, and it looks like a madhouse from the 19th century. The behavior, not the environment necessarily, but certainly the behavior from the prisoners. Talk to me a little bit about your first impressions when you met the prisoners that you would really follow for 3 years.
I don't know quite what I expected when I started making a film about solitary confinement, but I certainly expected a solitary confinement unit to be a quiet place. Mm. This is an isolation unit. This is where inmates are sent to be isolated. And what we found on our first day of filming, way back in 2013, was the exact opposite. The onslaught of noise when we first set foot in the unit was extraordinary. Inmates screaming, shouting, throwing themselves against their cell doors. And I asked an officer, like, is this just for us? Is this, is everyone putting on a show because we're here? And he sort of gave a rueful laugh and said, no, it's always like this. And it was. I mean, we filmed there on and off for 3 years. And to begin with, at least, it was an extraordinary, traumatic, horrific place to be, both for the inmates, for the officers who work there every day, and for us as journalists observing it. It's changed a lot now, and that's really what the film charts, is that shift from what was very common in the United States, still is in many states, these sort of solitary confinement units, which are horrific places to be, to something more humane.
Hmm. So let's talk about some of the reasons. Let's go back a little bit first, and then we'll talk about some of the reasons for that reform. Talk about the history of solitary confinement, and how is this practice sort of begun? It's sort of a Quaker experiment.
Yeah, it's really quite fascinating, the history of solitary confinement. We think of it as a punishment for the worst of the worst. But it was initially conceived in the United States as a chance for redemption, for rehabilitation, and for an inmate to do penance. That's where we get the word penitentiary from. It's somewhere where an inmate can do penance. And the idea was, this Quaker idea, was that if you put an inmate in a solitary cell with only a Bible for company, no interaction with guards or with other people, that solitude would bring him closer to God, and he would repent for his crimes. It's a kind of wonderful idea, but unfortunately it was a complete disaster in practice. Entire prisons were built on this principle in the United States and in Europe, but fairly soon the people running these prisons came to realize that rather than bringing inmates closer to God, it drove them insane. It made them mad, it made them violent, they would hallucinate, they would kill themselves, they would hurt themselves. And so solitary confinement was pretty much abandoned in the mid-19th century for all these reasons, only to be reinstituted as a tool of prison policy in the 1970s and the 1980s as prison populations rose dramatically and prisons became much harder to manage because there were too many inmates in them. And at that point really is the sort of rebirth of solitary confinement in the U.S., and it really took off so that in the 80s and the 90s, you had entire prisons. Most states have what's called a supermax prison, which is a prison entirely built on the principle that every inmate will be kept in solitary confinement for their stay. So now it's very hard to pinpoint the number of inmates in solitary confinement in the United States, but it's certainly more than 80,000.
Was the clinical evidence ignored at that point? Was it a lack of finding other solutions? Had people forgotten the lessons learned by the original American experiment of solitary confinement and the clinical results? Or why did it make such a comeback?
I think there's a degree to which those lessons had been forgotten. There is a degree to which they were ignored. We interviewed the warden of the federal prison, which, if you like, gave birth to modern solitary confinement, which started the policy again in 1982. And he said to me, look, I wish there was a magic wand. I wish there was a magic wand that we could wave to make really violent people behave better, but there's no such thing. And in my prison, in the prison he worked in, two officers had been killed in a single 24-hour period by two inmates in separate incidents. And he saw it as his job simply to protect his officers and to protect other inmates from violent inmates. And the only way he could see of doing this, given the hand he'd been dealt, but given the inmates coming to his prison, was to lock them in their cells.
Let's talk about some of these individuals that we follow and the impact it has on them. So these aren't necessarily people who are in for life. Sometimes these are people who are in for aggravated assault, arson, and who are going to be back in society very shortly. They had an awareness overall. You had conversations with them that solitary confinement or segregation was doing something to them. Do you think that they have an awareness because it's talked about now, or do you think they were just self-aware of, this is what's happening in my mind? I'm fine when I come down here for 3 days, 25 days, things aren't going well, I'm spending too much time with my thoughts. What was your notion of their self-awareness of this?
I think the debate around solitary confinement has not really permeated into the cells, at least the in the unit I worked in. The inmates were profoundly self-aware of the damage they thought solitary confinement was doing to them. They have nothing else to think about, actually. I mean, when I started filming there in 2013, inmates didn't have televisions in their cells in the main state prison. All they had to focus on was themselves and the few inmates they could see from their cell. And many of them would resort after a few days to hurting themselves as a tool. They would admit freely to me, I do it to get out of my cell. I do it because I know when I cut myself, the officers are going to come, they're going to suit themselves up, they're going to take me out of my cell so I can get stitches. And just for that moment of release, they would harm themselves.
Right. And we should tell listeners, how are they even getting a razor blade to harm themselves? Talk about this sort of the way that they're sharing objects with one another.
Inmates spend so long down in solitary, in some solitary units, that they have devised over the years ingenious ways of getting things around to each other. So if an inmate is sent down solitary, he may succeed in bringing with him some razor blades, some medications, some drugs that have been brought illegally into the prison. And then inmates in solitary will send this contraband from cell to cell using something that they call fishing. And I filmed this. It was an extraordinary thing that I wasn't expecting to see. Inmates will unravel their bedclothes or their clothes to make what they call a fishing line. And then with a lot of practice, years of practice in some case, they become very good at sending these kites, they call them, these kites, out of one cell and into another. And they can shoot these things, 40, 50 feet with great accuracy, without the officers noticing, and pass contraband around the solitary unit from cell to cell.
So once they have a razor blade with them and they're taken out, then the guards confiscate that, but somehow another one appears, because there's a lot of that, behavior again and again. And they're very strategic about how they make sure that the guards have to enter by covering. They know the policy. They know exactly what the policies and procedures are.
Absolutely, some of the inmates are very open to me about how they aim to provoke. They have nothing to lose down there. I mean, that's something that need to make clear, that the inmates feel they have nothing to lose. They're already being punished with the worst punishment the prison system can give them, and so why not fight the officers? Mm.
Let's talk about reforms and sort of the direction this begins to go, and it can't go particularly quickly. You can't just turn around and open the doors and send everyone back into general population. So how are officials sort of working on reforming the system to where it works, but yet keeps other inmates and guards as safe as possible?
Well, we arrived at the Maine State Prison. We started our project at a kind of historic moment, both in the history of that particular prison, but also in approaches to solitary confinement in the United States, in that many places were starting to feel that perhaps solitary was being overused and perhaps it had become counterproductive. And when we started filming in Maine, the then Commissioner of Corrections, a man called Joseph Pont, decided there were too many people in solitary in Maine, and it wasn't effective. And so what he set in train, if you like, which is what our film then followed over the ensuing 3 years, was a process by which, rather than languishing for years in solitary, the prison would use alternatives, different alternatives for different inmates. Now, one of the major problems was that mentally ill inmates, mm-hmm. who weren't necessarily violent, but they were hard to manage, and they were often vulnerable in a prison population, often ended up in solitary because the prison didn't have anything else to do with them.
Right.
And Maine opened a dedicated mental health treatment unit, which really cut the solitary population in half in that particular prison system because so many people were in there simply because they were mentally ill. It then instituted different regulations for what meant you ended up in solitary. So previously a minor infraction of a prison rule could land you in solitary for months, even years. Change that rule, no longer happened. It made it easier for inmates to work their way out of solitary by doing education and programming and proving that they want to change. That cut the population down further. And so over the period we were filming, just before I started there, there were more than 100 inmates in solitary confinement in the Maine State Prison. By the time we finished, there were 7. And that's a dramatic drop. And I think it illustrates perhaps the true proportion of inmates in any prison system who are truly, truly dangerous. I mean, I am the first to acknowledge, having spent so much time now in a maximum security prison, that some of the guys in there are truly, truly dangerous. And if you let them out of their cell, they're very likely to hurt someone or kill them.
And they will tell you that. Some of them will just tell you that.
Well, they'll tell me that to my face. The officers know that. The inmates know that. You know, I had several inmates, but not many, that's the thing, but several inmates who would look at me through the glass and tell me that they would kill an officer if they were let out of their cell. They'd even kill me. Mm. But that is a minute fraction of the number of inmates who've ended up in solitary over the years. You know, so we've gone from, in Maine, over 100 inmates to fewer than 10. And I think that's a more accurate reflection of the number of inmates who are truly dangerous than it was when we started filming.
And in the meantime, you see someone like Adam Brulat, if I'm saying his name correctly, who really is only in for 2 years, but he spends most of that time in segregation and does not come out the same person. Did he spend too much time in segregation? Did that contribute to, at the beginning, in the first day, he's polishing the window, saying, I'm going to keep this neat so I can look out. By the end of the 3 year, you're following him, he's not the same. He's not the same man anymore.
Yeah, he's not. And I think this is a key point that you hinted at a second ago that many people don't appreciate, and I didn't appreciate before I started looking into this story, is that the great majority of people in solitary confinement are going to get out of solitary confinement. They're going to get out of prison. They're going to be back in the community. And so it's in all of our interest to really know and understand and be talking about what are the psychological effects of solitary confinement. Because it's not for lifers. There are a few lifers in there and a few people doing life sentences, but it's mostly people like Adam Brulat, the chap in our film, who are going to get out. So if solitary confinement makes inmates less stable and more dangerous, then it's not in any of our interest for prisons to be using it, because someone like Adam Brulat, who was just in prison on a 2-year sentence, he'd committed an assault. You know, he was in prison. As he said to me, I deserve to be in prison. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't a murderer or a rapist. You know, he was a young guy who got into a fight and he was doing his prison sentence. But he spent a lot of that prison sentence in solitary confinement because he was hard to manage, because he was unstable, he was young, and he got into fights in prison. And as the film illustrates, it profoundly altered him. And I think he will be struggling with the effects of solitary confinement for many years. Now, people say to me when I tell them the story of Adam, like, well, if he couldn't do the time, he shouldn't have done the crime. You know, he deserved it. And putting that to one side for a minute, and I don't think we should put it to one side because it's an important issue, but if you do put it to one side, the fact remains that we have to ask ourselves as a community, Do we want our prisons to be sending people out at the end of their sentence more dangerous, more unstable than when they came in? And that's a key prism through which we should be sort of investigating and looking at the topic of solitary confinement.
And then we see Todd Fickett, and just this little glimpse of, you know, who he is at the beginning, and 3 years later, through the reforms and the classes and the mental health care he receives, he has this tiny bit of empathy that he didn't have before about even cutting himself and what that did to, he says, you know, I have to think about what that did to the correctional officers and what it did to the other inmates who had to watch it happen. And I just thought, oh, that's empathy, which he did not possess, 3 years earlier. So it takes a lot of work, but there was, you saw, would you say, you know, some of these reforms starting to have a positive impact?
Without a doubt, yeah. No, I think the reforms have actually been very effective. And if there's one sort of hopeful, redemptive strand in our film, it's that, you know, change is possible. And what the Maine State Prison have done is has made their prison a safer place. It's made their prison a more humane place. And for some inmates, it's definitely sort of turned their lives around in a more positive trajectory. I don't want to get naive. I mean, these are really difficult to manage people with difficult pasts, and they're not all going to come out as saints or angels. But as you say, the particular inmate you're talking about, Todd Fickett, started off when I met him in a very, very dark place, and had learned through classes, through programming, through treatment over the 3 years that we followed him to be a different person.
Yeah. Dan, what sticks with you now that the project is over and you move on to your next project? What will always stay with you with these men that you met?
I think there are two things that will always stay with me. One is the straightforward trauma of being in a solitary unit, both for the inmates, for the officers, and for me as a filmmaker. I've worked in war zones all over the world. I've seen terrible things. I've seen people do terrible things to other people. But frankly, nothing compared to the hell that was a solitary unit. That will stay with me. At the same time, what will also stay with me is the fact, as I said a moment ago, that change is possible, that that place that was hell on earth 3 years ago is very different now and almost empty, and that what the Maine State Prison have managed to do is become a more humane place without compromising on the safety of the people who live and work there.
Dan Edge is the producer and director of Last Days of Solitary. It's on Frontline tonight, South Dakota Public Broadcasting TV. That's at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Dan, thank you so much for the work that you've done and for being here with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.